Hello, welcome to 251, two pianists, five podcasts, one subject. And the subject of this series of podcasts is the piano player Kenny Drew. And this week we're going to talk about Kenny's contribution to the John Coltrane album Blue Train. My name's Nick Tomlin.
And I'm Simon Whiteside. Let's have a brief update of where Kenny is in his career. His first recording, he started in New York in 1950. He was on the album by Howard McGee, which also introduced Kenny Drew. That was part of the title of that album. And that track became, that was I Remember April, which was a solo feature. That track became the beginning of his own trio album in 1953. In the meantime, he'd played with the Miles Davis Sextet and made a couple of recordings live from Birdland. And 1952 through to 1954-ish, he also played with Buddy DeFranco, both in New York City and in Los Angeles. From 53 to 56, he spent quite a lot of time on the West Coast. So he had a trio album with Eugene Wright and Bobby White, who were the bass player and drummer from Buddy DeFranco's band later on. And in 1954, he played with Zoot Sims in a quintet recording. Also in 54, he played with Clifford Brown and Max Roach Septet, all of these recorded in Los Angeles. He did another trio with Wright, but this time with Lawrence Murrable on drums, again an LA recording. In 55, he recorded with Dexter Gordon, and the album which probably cemented their early relationship, called Daddy Plays the Horn, and that again was a Los Angeles recording. Dexter Gordon was a Los Angeles resident. And he then had another album under his own name on the West Coast. That was called the Kenny Drew Quartet, with Joe Maiani and Leroy Vinegar and Lawrence Marable again. In 1956, that's the year he began to think about moving back perhaps to New York City, which he did in August of that year, or at least his first recording is in August of that year. But in 1956, there's a crossover with our previous subject, Sonny Clark. He played on an album called Leonard Feather's West Coast Jazzman, and he played an instrument called the Vibrese, which is quite a weird thing. It was a sort of manual vibraphone, but Sonny Clark was the pianist on that date. So they both actually played on the same album, which is very rare for pianists. So a few more albums with in LA before he moved, one with Sonny Chris, one with Paul Chambers Quartet, and then a Sonny Chris Quintet album. It's then that he returns to New York City, and from 56 until he moves to Copenhagen, well, to Europe at least, but ending up in Copenhagen, he recorded almost exclusively in New York, and quite regularly at the Rudy Van Gelder studio for different labels. So in 56, he recorded with the Ernie Henry Quintet on Riverside. Then he had a trio album with Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones on Prestige. He played with Art Farmer's Quintet, again on Prestige, and Sonny Rollins Quartet on Prestige. He had a trio then with Wilbur Ware and G.T. Hogan for Riverside. And then he had, in 1957, a quintet album, quartet album for with Donald Byrd and Hank Mobley, same bass player and drummer as before. And that brings us to the recording he made later in that year, Blue Train, which has Lee Morgan, John Coltrane, obviously, Curtis Fuller, Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones in the rhythm section. That's the album we're going to be talking about today. That's a brief run through his career, which we haven't really been focusing too much on because we're looking at five albums that we consider to be significant. Have you got any points to make on that, Nick, before we move on?
No, I think that was a pretty comprehensive run through of his career, so I think we should move on to the album.
So we'll be talking about John Coltrane's Blue Train after this.
Blue Train was recorded on September the 15th, 1957, in the Van Gelder Studios in Hackensack. And John Coltrane had quite an eventful year up to this point. Earlier in 1957, he'd been sacked from Miles Davis's band, really because of his worsening heroin habit. But I think he saw that as a kind of a wake-up call, and he actually then went on to sort of kick heroin cold turkey. And by the sort of summer or early autumn of 1957, he'd started playing with Thelonious Monk. And around the time he recorded Blue Train, he was actually playing a residency with Monk at the Five Spot Cafe.
Yeah, that gig is mentioned on the liner notes by Robert Levin about the Five Spot gig and playing with Monk. And John Coltrane does cite both Miles Davis and Monk as big influences on his playing and on his concept of music in general. He talks about their, particularly Monk's harmony and Miles Davis's improvisational skills. But it's interesting to me that the Blue Note, you know, for the people who collect Blue Note, Blue Train is probably one of the key albums that people want, especially to try and get an original pressing. The 1500 series is a very collectible series for Blue Note enthusiasts. And Blue Train can go for, well, a good copy, mint copy, can go for up to $6,000, if not more, dollars. Richard Cook, in his Penguin Guide to Jazz on CD, actually dismissed this album as a perfect example of the Blue Note effect, an overvalued record which bathes in the cachet of what turned out to be a fleeting association with the most glamorous label of the time, which is kind of, well, I think it's pretty harsh, but, well, actually, and so did Loose Tubes. I don't know if you're a big Loose Tubes fan, Nick, but they did a tune where they all start singing, and one of the things they do is they say, who are your main influences? Richard Cook. Badoo, badoo, da. So slightly taking the mickey out of that assessment. But it's quite interesting to me that the Blue Train, I think that, you know, it's an iconic cover. It's, you know, musically, I think, one of John Coltrane's greatest albums. And it's also the seed, really, for me, the beginning of the route towards Giant Steps and beyond. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot musically to be said about this album.
And it was the only Blue Note album that he recorded as leader. That's correct, isn't it? I think he was on other Blue Note albums, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, he did. Obviously, we haven't yet mentioned that he'd quite recently played. In fact, you know, 2 weeks before he'd recorded with Sonny Clark. And there's some quite interesting crossovers between the two albums.
Well, Sonny's Crib, wasn't it?
Yeah, Sonny's Crib, and particularly that tune, Sonny's Crib, which is the same sort of format as Locomotion. And of course, John Coltrane appeared courtesy of Prestige. It even says that on the album sleeve. Mm.
So he was never really signed to Blue Note. No.
He was doing those gigs as a, you know, he was lent out, basically. Mm. Much like, you know, film stars were, for example. So we're going to talk about the first track, the title track, Blue Train. And it's an E-flat blues, isn't it?
Yeah, it is blues in E-flat. What's quite distinctive about it is uses these particular flat 10 voicings in the piano, which gives it a kind of... So it's a major blues, but it's got a slight kind of minor feel as well, and I wonder whether that was Kenny Drew's kind of input. I wonder whether, you know, Coltrane just wrote it as an E flat blues, and maybe Kenny Drew came up with those voicings, or whether Coltrane was very specific about those voicings. It's interesting, but they really give it a particular mood, don't they? Those voicings that Kenny Drew uses.
Yeah, I think the. Well, I'm interested you've called it a flat 10. Why did you call it a flat 10, not a sharp 9?
I don't know. I mean, you could call it either. Yeah, could call it either.
I mean, in my, you know, sort of way of thinking of harmony, a sharp 9 contains the major third and the minor third. Do you have any elucidation on your flat 10 description?
No, I mean, I kind of use them interchangeably, really. Sharp 9 and flat 10.
The tune has, because it's basically a blues derived lick, isn't it? The I guess the thing with that is that you are always going to have the minor third in there, aren't you, on the blues scale?
Yeah, it's part of the blues scale.
But I think those flat nine voicings and also the sharp, well, the 13 sharp 11 on the second chord are quite interesting. And they're not often, it's one of those tunes that is often played, but not in the original, with the original chords,
yeah,
if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's played as a C minor blues, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's not really a minor blues. Although I think when I'm listening to it, I do think that when they open up into the solos, it becomes a lot more major than the tune itself.
Mm.
And for that reason, I think it's got a definite ambiguity as to its major or minorness.
Yeah, yeah.
And it finishes on that sharp nine sound, so there's the minor third in there very quite strongly, especially with the fact that it's related to the minor scale, a semitone up the altered scale. The other thing we have to think about with this album is it's very well constructed, and that comes from, I think, the Blue Note tendency we've mentioned before to have rehearsals. And this album is very clearly well rehearsed, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, some of the tunes, well, we'll go on to talk about, you know, some couple of the tunes on this album probably couldn't really have been done without a rehearsal, I think.
No, and also harmony parts have been worked out on nearly every tune.
Yeah.
And sometimes even sort of backing figures have been worked out.
Yeah.
So in this tune, we've got, you know, whatever horns aren't playing, they play a bit of backing,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah.
Let's talk about Kenny Drew's solo on this then. It's obviously a blues, and he's obviously a blues-infused player. In fact, I think he's described as one of the funky pianists by the on the liner notes of this album. But he definitely uses his blues chops on this, which is no surprise. But one of the things he does do, which not all of the soloists do, is there seems to be a ploy, which may also have been agreed in the rehearsal, that at a certain point after a few choruses of normal time, the drums will go into double time. Paul Chambers stays in normal time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the other soloists just stay in normal time and let the drums do the double time feel. But Kenny really takes that on, doesn't he?
Mm.
And I slightly chickened out after the first two choruses transcribing his solo, which we'll make available on our Patreon page. But he does go into double time, and it's a quick double time on this particular speed. And also, I think he sounds to me the most Wynton Kelly-like of anything I've heard, really, on this particular album. And of course, Wynton Kelly was in and around the Miles Davis unit at this time, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And emerging himself as a player. In fact, I think Wynton Kelly may have been on one of those New Sounds, New Faces, introducing, I think that Kelly Blue might be one of those albums that we talked about, where introducing Kenny Drew was part of that series. Do you have any thoughts on the solo?
No, other than, as you say, it's interesting that he definitely responds to the drums going into double time. It seems to be, you know, you hear Paul Chambers and Philly Joe doing this quite a lot, don't you? They do this kind of thing where Philly Joe will go into double time, but Paul Chambers stays in normal time.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting effect which they use. It's obviously a kind of routine that they do.
Yeah. What I found listening to this album in more detail, it's obviously an album we're both very familiar with, and many people listening to this will know this album very well. But it's interesting to me that it seems to be an agreed formula on this one. It happens in every soloist.
Yeah, it is. It's worked out for sure. Yeah.
It's not a on the cuff, off the cuff.
No.
Thing. So let's move on to talk about Moment's Notice.
Moment's Notice is the second tune on Blue Train, and it's a very interesting tune harmonically. And in some ways, it's the result of Coltrane's experiment with what sometimes called extended or embellished cadences. Now, a cadence, in musical terms, it's really just a a progression of chords moving from the really from the chord 5 to the chord 1. So in the key of C, that would be from G to C. And very often this is preceded by the 2 chord. So, you know, the name of this series is 2-5-1, and really part of it comes from this progression, which is one of the sort of fundamental progressions in jazz. So maybe, Simon, could you play, let's say, a 2-5-1 in the key of C, just so we can hear how that sounds? Great. Yeah, so that's a 2-5-1 cadence, very sort of traditional way of resolving that. What Coltrane started to experiment with around this time were different ways of resolving. So instead of moving to the C from the G, you could move somewhere else, for example. One of the most common is what sometimes gets called the backdoor cadence, where instead of moving down a fifth from the G to the C, you would move up a tone from the G to the A. So if you could just play this, Simon. So basically this progression would be D minor, G7, and then A major. Could we just have a listen to how that sounds? So you can hear that it sort of has a similar effect as the first one, but it's slightly different. It still kind of resolves, but it resolves in a different way. And Coltrane started to become quite interested in these types of cadences. That's only one example of this sort of cadence. I don't know if you've got anything else you want to add about that at this point, Simon.
Well, for me, the first time I encountered this, and I think it's a tune that a lot of people play, is in the bridge of Have You Met Miss Jones, which is quite a well-known tune, and certainly being recorded a lot in the 1950s, I think we can be fairly certain that John Coltrane knew it and played it. But I think what he does here in Moment's Notice is very interesting in terms of reharmonizing one note as well. So what we have is... It starts in the wrong place, doesn't it? It's a tune in E flat again, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally. But it doesn't start in E flat at all, so that's nowhere near E flat. So he starts off a semitone up. But what he does in the tune is he keeps the melody note, which is the minor third of E minor, is the same as the major third of E flat major. So he's able to do this. Mm-hmm. So he kind of softens, in a way, he softens that strangeness, doesn't he? Because he's not playing... He's playing a note from E-flat, basically, mm-hmm. But with different chords underneath.
Yeah, so the G sort of ties the whole thing together, doesn't it? The repeated G in the melody.
Absolutely. And the other interesting thing for me in terms of this tune is he opens the tune with a completely separate melody, doesn't he? So there's 8 bars. In fact, there's more than 8 bars because it goes into that sort of tag figure. He does 16 bars of a thing we only hear once at the very beginning of this tune.
I think the other thing we should probably say is that this type of tune is very difficult to improvise over, mainly because musicians tend to get used to playing certain cadences, 2-5-1 cadence. They have a kind of vocabulary based around that, and then suddenly you have a tune which is modulating into different keys, and it's quite challenging. And in fact, as far as I understand, the title "Moment's Notice" came from something Curtis Fuller said when they were rehearsing this tune, and he said that he was having trouble with it, and he said that he shouldn't be expected to blow over this tune at a moment's notice, which is interesting. And a lot of the players, even the best players around, really struggled on some of this stuff. You know, it was quite a new way of arranging harmony, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are tunes which have this already. Mm. Certainly some of Charlie Parker's tunes do something approaching this.
Mm.
Maybe not as consistently and changing. I mean, I've done a little analysis of the 2-5s or the false 2-5s, whatever you want to call them, in this tune. And what he does is he sort of delays the key centre until the third bar. So normally music's in 4-bar, 8-bar, 16-bar, 32-bar chunks. Certainly popular music often is. So normally you'd start this tune. I mean, you can play this tune. I had a go playing this tune without the false 2-5-1s, and it sounds okay.
Mm.
And then we move off.
Mm-hmm.
So it does actually work with the tonic, but he avoids the tonic until the bar three. So in bar three, we're in E flat. Then he does the same thing a tone down, so we end up in D flat. And at the end of that second phrase, he moves to C minor for the bar nine. And that is the relative minor of E flat. So relative minor keys are the ones that have the same key signature as the major key they're related to. So C minor has three flats, and so does E flat. And then he moves quickly away. Again, he does this tone relationship. He goes to A flat at bar 11, and then G flat at bar 15. So it's a sort of similar shape to the A section. So it's an A, B, A, C tune, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
With the tag added as well. And it looks like he's going to go back to E flat. So he's going... So that's where we're in G flat. And then, of course, we go to... Which makes it much more of a surprise, I think. Because he's really setting up the E flat and then doesn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
So then the second half is almost the same, except with all these A, B, A, C tunes, it's the end of the second section, which is very different. And he has this really nice...
vamp section. Yeah.
And then in half time. So, yeah, a really interesting tune. It does throw up some interesting challenges for the improvisers, but because they had a rehearsal, they all manage it very well, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I think to be honest, I mean, I think Kenny sort of runs out of steam a little bit towards the end of his solo, but he, you know, as you said, he copes with it really well. It doesn't sound like they're struggling on this at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he runs out of... I don't think he loses the plot terms of the chords. I just think he is less inspired by the changes.
Yeah.
I mean, remembering that a lot of these players, including Kenny, have played a great deal of tunes which stay in the same key.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is quite exhausting. Learning a new concept in jazz, for example, you really feel your brain getting fried, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to get your head around it. And after a while, that becomes, like with sport, it becomes an automatic, deep-learnt thing. So we don't think about, you and I don't really think about 2-1-6-2-5 type. That progression, that's so ingrained in our in our minds now that we're not really thinking about what those chords are. We're improvising on stuff which... sits on that foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
And that foundation's been removed in this tune,
which
I think is, you know, why someone... Is it Tommy Flanagan on Giant Steps who struggles a great deal to keep up?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's rather unfair to always point that out, but he was the pianist on that date, so...
Yeah, although Giant Steps is a kind of even a step beyond, in a way, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And, you know, in many respects, John Coltrane, he didn't really like that tune, did he? He said, well, it was just an exercise I was working on. We played it and it's become famous, really, in a way that he perhaps... You know, composers often have this. Ravel didn't like Bolero, for example. But Sanson didn't like Carnival of the Animals. There's quite a lot of it. Who knows what Kenny G likes? The money, probably. Anyway, it's a very interesting tune, and they finish on every time round, and they keep doing this handoff of two bars as well, don't they? Each time,
yeah.
They do that tag every time, which really sets up an energy. To release, and again they finish on this sort of sharp nine
sharp
sound,
nine. Yeah, know. Which kind of links it in a way to Blue Train in a way, the sound of it, the last chord.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the end of the first side of this album. Do you have anything to add before we flip?
No, I mean, I just also would quite like to mention Kenny Drew's little break, because as you said, there's a two-bar break at the end of every time around the head, and he plays a great little two-bar break, which, for example, if I play this tune, I tend to play that break, because I think it's almost become part of the tune, really. That
right, you mean the one into his solo or the one in the middle of the solo?
The one, well, he does it, I think he does it between...
In the tune.
But he also does it into his solo as well. He does it exactly the same into his solo. So it's kind of, I think it's maybe something he worked out, but it really works nicely in the tune. And
no, absolutely. I know what you mean. Mm. Yes. So before the repeat, you mean?
Yes, before the repeat. Yeah.
I mean, I found the one in the middle of his solo is a little bit rushed, and it slightly throws the rhythm section on the way back in. But certainly, yeah, I know what you mean. That's almost, well, it's almost like the Charlie Parker one, isn't it? That everyone, that's so good, a lot of people play.
You mean the Night in Tunisia?
The Night in Tunisia one, yes. Yeah. And there are other examples. There's a Lee Morgan famous one from the Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Anyway, shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
Right, so we're going to flip the original record now and go on to side B. So, side B has three tunes on it, the first one being Locomotion. Locomotion is another blues, this time it's a B-flat blues, but it's a blues with a difference, which is it has a bridge. So, for those of you who are not familiar with jazz lingo, a bridge is a section which is different, which allows you to have three sections that are the same, punctuated. So, A-A, B-A. It just allows for tension and release. So the blues, a 12-bar sequence, is the A, and then the middle of the tune, it has a move away from B-flat and a move back towards it. And actually, it's quite an interesting progression, isn't it? It's And the other interesting thing about blues progressions is that although we say it's a blues in B-flat, the initial chord is a B-flat 7, which in a sense is a dominant chord. But it's that sort of weird static dominant sound, isn't it, that that you get with blues, particularly in this period. Earlier blues players would play quite a lot of B-flat 6 for a while, wouldn't they? So they will keep the tonality more home, as it were. But by the time we get to bebop, it's always seventh chords, isn't it? Pretty much always, anyway. And it's related, perhaps related, to Sonny Clark's tune Sonny's Crib, which was recorded a couple of weeks earlier with John Coltrane on sax for Sonny's date. But although, as you've pointed out, Nick, it's almost like Sonny's Crib is similar to Blue Train as a tune, as a melody, but then similar to Locomotion as a form, although his bridge is very different, isn't it? And then the other thing about this is that at the end of this tune, there is a coda, which has an interesting set of descending chords, which starts on B-flat 7, flat 5, which is sort of the home key, for want of a better word. But that flat 5 gives it sort of whole tone feeling, doesn't it? And then he does go down a whole tone scale.
Yeah, it sort of descends a whole tone scale.
And then ends up on, it's sort of, I mean, it could be described as B7 over F. But really, I think it's a sort of F whole tone type sound in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which has obviously got nothing to do with B flat, save for the fact that it's, you know, the fifth. But it does sound, I think, because your ear gets confused, as it were, from the descending set of chords, which are slightly dissonant. You accept that as a landing place, don't you, at the end? And you've actually taken down the solo on this, and you've got some things to say about it, haven't you?
Yeah, so I transcribed the solo. He just does one sort of full chorus on this, which includes the, because it's an AABA sort of blues form. I was just kind of looking at, especially relating it to the other solos that I transcribed, and just seeing if there are any kind of common devices he's using. I mean, one thing he seems to use a lot is triads. So a triad is just it's a three note chord, which normally consists, you can have different triads, but the tonic triad is just the root, the third and the fifth of a particular chord. In jazz, musicians started experimenting really with playing triads over chords. They're quite interesting triads because they can give you different kind of flavors depending on which triad you choose over which particular chord. Now, the first example I picked out of this solo here is using an E major triad. So that would be E, G sharp and B. Yeah. But he's using that over a B flat 7 chord. Which is quite dissonant sound. But in a way, it sort of works because if you're analysing in terms of the B flat 7, the E would be the sharp 11 of the B flat. The G sharp, if you're looking at it enharmonically, it would be A flat, so it's the flat 7th. And then the B is the flat 9th. So all of those notes really can be justified within B flat 7. But it's a good way of kind of organising. And because the thing about triad also, it's a very stable sound. So you can actually get away with playing some quite dissonant sounds using triads. And this would be developed actually by Coltrane himself, but also players moving on from John Coltrane and using his example, really started experimenting with different triads over chords to get different sort of sounds. But this is an example of Kenny Drew doing it. Yeah, so this is basically, it's a little phrase which uses an E major arpeggio over a B flat 7 chord. So I'll just play that now. And the next example I picked out, again, sort of relates back to the first solo that I transcribed of his, which was Be My Love from the Trio album. And it's this use of, it's this little kind of displacement lick, which again, I think traces back to Bud Powell. I've heard Bud Powell do this a lot. It's just where you take a little phrase, which is really, it's really a three beat phrase, but you're using it obviously in 4-4. So again, it creates this sort of shifting time feel. And let's just have a listen to that. So this is, this is a little example of this displacement phrase. And what's interesting there is he ends that phrase again with an E major arpeggio, but this time he's using it over G7, a G7 chord. So you end up with different extensions of the G7. So in that case, the E becomes the 13th. Yeah, the A flat becomes the flat 9th, and obviously the B is the 3rd of G7. So again, I think he's really thinking about using these different arpeggios over different chords to create different effects, which is quite a progressive, way of thinking about arpeggios and chords. And as I said, it would be taken up by other players and really explored in a lot greater depth sort of later on.
And I think the other thing about that is if you think about it the other way around, you can think, what can I use E major for? So you can think about it from the top down, as it were. So you can have a lick which is essentially based on the E major triad, and it fits over different chords.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So yes, you can work out, you can actually just work it out, take one triad and see how it works with different chords, which I think is what musicians were doing around this time. And the last little phrase that I've chosen, slightly different, but here he's using an augmented triad. So an augmented triad is just it's like a tonic triad, but with the fifth has been raised by a semitone. So In the key, he's playing an F7 chord, but what he uses is a G augmented triad. So that's a G, a B, and then an E flat over the F7. Yeah, so here's that example.
Are there any other interesting elements to this tune that you'd like to pull out?
Well, it is interesting that they play around a little bit with the form. So, for example, for the trombone solo, the trumpet solo, not the piano solo, but also the drum solo, they add 8 bars before the solo starts, sort of 8 bars of kind of B-flat 7, really, but without any. It's like a pickup, so the instrument plays just 8 bars on its own before the form actually starts.
Yeah, I wonder if that's related to the fact that the whole thing itself starts with an 8-bar drum introduction.
Yeah, and also it's interesting that the drum solo, because initially when I listened to the drum solo, I thought he's maybe got lost, but then when I re-listened to it, I realised that he does actually just play the 8 bars, and then he plays a chorus. So it's interesting that they're sort of definitely keeping this form as they're soloing.
Yeah, and also the other thing that we probably ought to mention about the tune is that normally, or not always, but quite often, you have a blues riff which fits over all 3-4-bar sections mm-hmm. of a blues, don't you? Whereas with this tune, it's like 2 8-bar sections played by the band, as it were, and then John Coltrane solos over the last 4 bars of each of the blues A sections, as it were, which also makes for an interesting feel, because it feels like it's an 8-bar tune with a tag, opposed to a 12-bar tune.
Yeah,
and often, I mean, blues obviously come in all varied shapes and forms, but yeah, I do find that quite interesting. And of course, we have that another end. So again, we have this idea of how much the rehearsal may have impacted on. You wouldn't get this on a prestige recording.
No. I mean, something certainly. Like that, you could only really do with rehearsal. You wouldn't just kind of throw that on the band in the, you know, they've obviously worked all this out in advance in the rehearsal.
We've got 2 more tunes to talk about. The first one is revisiting a tune which we had in the Chet Baker album. It's I'm Old Fashioned.
I'm Old Fashioned was written by Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer in 1942 for the film You Were Never Lovelier. And in the film, it was, it was sung by Fred Astaire and sort of lip-synced by Rita Hayworth. I don't think she actually sang it, but they did a kind of a duet with this song. And it's become, by this point, it's become quite a well-known jazz standard. And in fact, it's the only standard that they actually record on this album. All the others are originals.
Yeah, and we know that Alfred Lion was particularly keen on people playing originals where possible for clearances and publishing and all those sorts of things. So, as you said, it was an Astaire Hayworth film that this tune was written for, very much a romantic tune in that, but often played as a ballad. And what's interesting is E flat does seem to be the key of this album that's favoured, because they do it in E flat, which is not the key most people play it in. Generally speaking, I play it in F. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I tend to play it in F.
That's the kind of real book in inverted commas key. And in fact, in It Could Happen to You, which obviously we talked about in our previous podcast, but in fact, chronologically, it comes after this album, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, on that album, they do it in A flat. So, and that's probably a singer thing for Chet Baker to sing it. But the is it? I've taken this solo down, and I've done a few of his ballads now, and I have to say it's quite a challenge, because he does have these rapid notes. He's one of those people who doesn't, play in the time of the ballad. He tends to play some rapid stuff as well. But what I found very interesting was that he's very fluidly able to move, and it's quite a skill, something that a lot of jazz pianists find quite difficult, is moving between a triplet feel, which he does a lot in this, and a semiquaver feel, and then also double of that twice as quick as mm-hmm. semiquavers. And there's a lot of embellishment and a lot of fluidity in what we call rubato in music, which is to kind of stretch and make the time feel elastic, which gives a nice sort of tension and release within time as opposed to necessarily harmony. And although there are a few things which that are similar, there's in I'm Old Fashioned, we have this, it's quite a simple, straightforward 1-6-2-5 progression that we talked about. But then on the next section, we have what's called a four chord over, sort of amen feeling. And on both solos, he does something very similar, which is to sort of go over that sort of sound, or almost like playing the tune. That sort of thing, where he's being quite fluid with the time on it, but he's fundamentally playing the tune. Mm. And what I've noticed in his ballad playing is he very often refers to the tune within his soloing. So he'll, for example, on the section that goes... So... You know, how the tune... He's sort of soloing slightly around the tune in a more the Lester Young way of soloing, rather than perhaps taking the changes and looking at what you can extrapolate from those. It's a really interesting solo, and I love his use of triplets. So he starts off with a triplet phrase. And then he goes into that semiquaver stuff I was talking about. So that will be up on our Patreon page for you to have a look at. There's some really nice lines in it. There's some he uses quite a lot of embellishment. That sort of those little turns and things. And the other one phrase that I was really attracted to is there's something which sounds a little bit Bill Evans-y. So he runs up very quickly to three notes coming down in thirds, which you hear quite a lot in Bill Evans playing. Again, an emerging player on the scene. I can't remember exactly when New Jazz Conceptions comes out. It's late 50s, mm-hmm. isn't it? 56, 57, 58, not sure exactly when. Mm-hmm. So if you are willing to throw us a few quid each month towards our endeavours in the podcast, you will get access to these transcriptions that we're talking about. And that's on our Patreon page. You just need to search for 251, 2-5-1 on Patreon. We'll have a link anyway in the show notes. We're going to talk about the last tune now, Lazy Bird.
Lazy Bird is the last track on Blue Train, and it's really another of Coltrane's sort of experiments in these, whatever you want to call them, extended cadences, altered cadences. And it's probably influenced by a tune called Lady Bird by the composer Tad Dameron. Although, having said that, it's not immediately obvious what the connection is. When you look at them on paper, they don't seem to be that similar. Other than, I think, it's really the way... He was interested in the way Tad Dameron, again, is using these unusual cadences. So in Lady Bird, the tune, we have two bars of C major, and then it goes to F minor 7, B flat 7, which in sort of traditional functional harmony, you would expect to move to E flat major. It's like it's modulating to E flat major, but in actual fact, it doesn't. It goes back to C major.
Shall I play that?
Yes, maybe you could play that song. Yeah, so it's this backdoor cadence. It's resolving up a tone rather than down a fifth. And for people who are interested in this subject, these altered cadences or extended cadences, There's quite a good paper on this online. There's a pianist called Jason Lyon who has a website, and he wrote a little paper on this called Coltrane Substitution Tune. So it's the tunes that Coltrane wrote where he's really using these chord substitutions. So if you search for that,
well, we'll put that link into the show notes.
Yeah, but it's worth reading, and it goes into it in more depth for people who are interested in that sort of stuff.
That's a good one. So obviously Kenny solos on this. I think we could probably have a very quick discussion on his overall soloing on this album and what we think about that. My thoughts are that in comparison to the Chet Baker album, this is a lot more for the jazz community, if that makes sense, whereas the Chet Baker album is perhaps more for the popular
side
of jazz. Yes. And this is a real... I think this is an art album, for want of a better word, whereas maybe the Chet Baker is a pop album. But for me, he's in very strong company. He's really trying to show his credentials in strong company.
Mm.
And John Coltrane handpicked that band. It's not... Normally, Alfred Lion would sort of make suggestions, mm-hmm. stick people together.
Mm-hmm.
John Coltrane agreed on a handshake to do an album under his own name, mm-hmm. for Blue Note, which Prestige agreed to. But his proviso was, I get to pick the band.
Mm.
And yes, I mean, obviously he's picked from people who have all played on Blue Note already. It's not like he's throwing anyone new into the mix. However, I think Kenny Drew on this does play at some of his... strongest for me so far out of the albums we've spoken about so far,
especially considering how difficult some of the material is. You know, he really copes with it well, especially if you compare it again with Tommy Flanagan, who's a similar pianist in a way to Kenny Drew, but he struggles a lot more on Giant Steps than the later Coltrane album. Whereas with Kenny Drew on this, you know he really kind of takes it in his stride, doesn't he? Those tricky tunes, you know.
He does, and he is a power player, isn't he, Kenny? You know, if we compare him with Sonny Clarke, and we can do that within, you know, the 2 week period difference that John Coltrane has played with those two pianists. Sonny Clarke is a much more logical, quaver-based, triplet-based player, whereas Kenny Drew has got has more octane and
more firepower
in terms of speed.
Yeah,
I would say his ideas are not quite as sort of flowing as Sonny Clarke's ideas, but he can certainly. I mean, he's got a lot of material, hasn't he, in his playing?
Yeah, absolutely.
He doesn't repeat himself. He's not a licks only player.
No.
I mean, obviously, there's the blues inflection stuff, which ends up being what it is whenever it's played. But when he's playing on changes, there's quite a lot of, like you say, the triadic ideas.
Yeah, he's got a lot happening in his playing, for sure.
We've already noted that he favours the sort of whole tone sound, which comes on the altered scale and the whole tone scale. So that's this... that sort of sound, and if you have a seventh chord, which is sometimes described as the altered, or the sometimes people call it the sharp nine scale, don't they? It's got a diminished element, and it's got a whole tone element.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's also called the diminished whole tone scale.
Yes, yeah.
But those things come into his playing, and I find him harmonically. He is, you know, he's using that triad stuff to create the sharp 11, 13 sound.
Mm-hmm.
He's using the one that you mentioned, mm-hmm. the E over G, and various sort of different versions of. So he's also using it there, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
As a more tense chord. Yeah, so I think for me, this is one of his real great outings as a player.
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree, for sure.
So we're just going to wrap up and tell you what's coming next on the next podcast.
Next time, we're going to look at the Kenny Drew album, Undercurrent. which he recorded in 1961 for Blue Note again. And we chose this album for a couple of reasons. It's because it's a leader date, so he put the band together, it's his session, and also he recorded all original tunes on this album.
Yes, and that's going to give us a chance to talk about him and his writing and the way in which he worked with other musicians. Now, we've had quite a lot of, in a way, we've had an embarrassment of riches to choose from. He recorded a very large number of records, particularly after leaving the United States. So we've been trying to pick out albums which we think best illustrate parts of his career without sort of going into, I mean, it would be a sort of a five-year project if we did every album. So that's one of the reasons we've chosen the ones that we have. There are plenty of other great albums that he's on. We might get some a discography on our Facebook page, which is 251 on Facebook. We've got the Patreon page, which we've talked about. We'd really like to be able to play some of clips in our future podcasts, but that requires us to spend money buying the rights. So if anyone is willing to throw us £3 a month or something like that, we can be saving that up to clear music to be played on the podcast. If you have comments, thoughts, add them on your favourite podcast provider, and we'll put links into the various things we've talked about in the show. But that's it for this week. So from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.